Welcome back to the podcast with me, your host, Pete Tigis. I'm really, really pleased to have Will Shaw and Mark Surtees back to talk some more about casting. There's going to be plenty of tips, tricks and all sorts of other stuff. And also, interestingly, the teaching process. So aspiring instructors, you might find this interesting as well. But also people, if they're looking to sharpen up their casting a little bit, I think there's going to be plenty of nuggets for you out there. So I'm really looking forward to this. But gentlemen, I'd really like to give you a warm welcome back. Let's start the important stuff first. Mark, have you been fishing?
Yes, I'd like to say I've been fishing successfully, but it's been a little bit tricky in the cold weather and the wind in the last few days. Been a lot of granum coming where I was, but there've been no fish coming to the granum. So I've picked up a few fingerlings, but nothing of any consequence.
It's interesting you say about the granum, because it usually peaks around now at home, and I reckon that warm day at the back end of March was when we had it, and I think it's pretty much all gone. From what I can see, there's the odd ones knocking round at the moment, and I don't know if we take those as positive, negative signs, whatever they're supposed to be, but the wind's been a bit challenging as well, hasn't it, Mark?
I'd like to say, Pete, that the wind would give me some colour in my cheeks, but you can probably tell from the camera that I'm still a pale wraith of a creature. The wind definitely was challenging. And the river where I was on the Avon in Wiltshire was pushing through a little bit. And, for a fat old bloke, it made for a difficult day.
As long as you enjoy it, that's the most important thing. Will, how about you? What have you been up to?
I've been out. I actually need a bit of therapy, guys. I lost probably the biggest UK brown trout I've ever hooked last week. What was worse was I kind of found the trout when I was grayling fishing in the winter. And I knew where it was, and I thought I fancy catching it on dry fly. And I had a plan. March browns. I was going to sit it out, wait for it to come up. And amazingly, it came up the first afternoon I was there, and I had it all planned, the cast. I made the cast, lovely reach cast, bit of slack in there, fish came up, took it, had it on for about a minute, and then pinged it out. It when I hooked it, it came out of the water like a cruise missile, so it was the one. I'm gonna have to go back and reacquaint myself.
So for listeners and myself and Mark, I'm sure as well, what do you reckon size-wise?
I know it was about 7.5, something like that. Yeah. It was an absolute beast. Yeah. Yeah.
Lay down on my couch and we'll talk through that one as well, because I don't know. I've written some things called Dealing with Loss. And they're the ones, isn't it funny, I don't know if you have the same, Mark, as well, that it's the ones that you lose you seem to feel and remember the most.
Well, all my biggest fish are the ones that I lost. I remember some of them, but others I just sort of kind of eradicated from my mind because I probably lost them. It was entirely my fault. So there's a few that just drop off, but there's others where you just balls it up. And they're always bigger than the ones you get on the bank.
Aren't they? Yeah.
And Will, for you then, when that fish came off, what do you do? Do you carry on fishing because you were looking for that fish, or do you just wind it in, say a few choice words, and then walk away, think about it? What was your reaction?
Yeah. So my immediate reaction was I just collapsed. My kind of legs went from under me. And there's just you just have to wait for the adrenaline to kind of subside. So head in hands. I phoned a friend for some immediate on bank therapy, which was quite useful. And then I nearly reeled in and went home. But I kind of went to a different pool and just made a few casts just to kind of like, so that, the last thing I did was something positive. Yeah. So I did catch one little trout, but yeah. So yeah, had to talk to someone, and then make a few casts, and then I went home.
Let's throw this the other way then, Mark. You come at this one first. That say you do catch a really nice fish, do you then carry on fishing, or do you snip off and go home? Because I'll quite often, if I've had a nice one, think, wow, that was extraordinary, and I wouldn't be able to do anything else after that justice. Of course, there is in the background, well, something might be around the corner, but how do you, if you've landed a magnificent fish, what is the next thing that you tend to do? Do you carry on?
Well, so I'm going to get a bit airy-fairy here now, because it's not necessarily just about a magnificent fish. So I remember, there are days you remember, and I remember one particular day fishing in Iceland, where I'd waded round the bottom end of an island to work up the other side of the island. And there were about three or four fish rising up that bank. And I caught every single one of them. They weren't big fish, not by Icelandic standards, but they were beautiful wild brown trout in this extraordinary place. I caught these four fish, and then I thought, well, I might as well go and just sit and have a beer and think about that now, because what's the point of – it was perfect. Yeah. And it was quite kind of – I felt strangely zenny after this experience. So I waded out and went and had a beer.
Yeah, good move.
That sounds civilized. How about you, Will?
Yeah, I'm the same. I've done exactly as you said, Pete. I've caught a fish and just thought, well, that's me done for the day. I can't top that, and I'll just enjoy the feeling. And it's a nice feeling, actually. It's that kind of feeling of fulfillment that it's given you everything that you wanted, I think. And I'm with you on that. I think it's very easy in your enthusiasm, especially when you're kind of younger, and you just want to keep going and keep catching more and more. And I think you have to go. I suspect you have to go through that in your career. Of just keep catching, and you kind of realize, I think, I wrote something ages ago about you kind of step over the line without knowing it, and you're suddenly thinking, I really wasn't bothered about that last fish. And how many have I caught? Was it a dozen? Was it eight? I don't know, you know. And at that point, kind of, well, what was the point of the last fish? I might have, you know. So I think you have to go through that to get to a point where you kind of recognise exactly what Mark was saying. That's enough. I'm done. Yeah.
I think if you're fishing with other anglers, Pete, because Will and I have both fished together, and it can get a bit competitive during the day. And also, when I go out now, I really only have one objective, and that is to catch one fish. And once I've got that, then I'm off the hook. If I don't catch any fish, then I can be very bad company indeed. So even at these sort of long days that we get out today, not today, but, you know, over the summer, if I don't catch anything, I'm going to be very poor company.
Can you testify to that, Will?
Yeah. No, not at all. He's excellent company, I've got to say.
Before we move on, there was one question, because you were saying you were stalking this fish, and I was thinking about this sort of snipping off and going home, and I wonder if it is a function of that style of fishing, that if you are stalking a fish, that it's easier to do that, isn't it? Because you've achieved your goal in many respects, hasn't it? That you've seen that fish rising, you've cast to it, okay, it's eaten it, but it's come off. But that's the deal almost, isn't it? That's what you're there for that thing. So it's much easier, I think, to snip off rather than if you were fishing the water or doing whatever. I wonder, it just dawned on me then.
There's an interesting thing. I read it ages ago in a book on carp fishing by Chris Yates. And he said, it's just a phrase he used, which he said he'd realized after all these years he was fishing for an image. And I think often we have a kind of an image in our head of what we want to kind of do when we go fishing. And there are those moments when that image is just fulfilled. You know, you've done the thing that was in your head. and that's complete. You know, you've completed it then. And I think that's an important thing that allows you to kind of stop. It's like, well, yeah, that was what I was after. That image has been ticked off in my brain, and I can go home happy. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Right. Well, for listeners, if you're regular listeners, you'll know that this is the second in a trilogy of conversations that I'm having with Will and Mark about not just the teaching process, but casting as well. And the podcast reaches quite a few people. And just wondered, Mark, did you get much feedback from the last episode that we recorded from user sort of instructors, but also anglers as a whole?
Well, I got an extraordinarily rude comment from Mr. Mike Heritage, who considered it to be extremely boring because he's heard me rabbiting on about it for the last 12 years. And he has now dedicated his life to watching sparrows through binoculars rather than instructing. So I put that to one side. but his point, I guess, was that sometimes when we're talking about instructing, we don't really make it accessible for people who are not instructors. And how do we make our instruction relevant to ordinary recreational casters? It's a big deal for me. I think we spend a lot of time talking about how we instruct instructors or instructing principles and things which are a bit arcane for somebody who just wants to go out and get a day's fishing. That is a thing that I think that is worth considering as we go on through these podcasts, perhaps.
How about you, Will?
Yeah, no, all good feedback, I think, from instructors and non-instructors. I think there is there's an appetite out there from instructors to extend their skills and build their skills genuinely. And I think some of the non-instructors, even non-fishers who have listened to your podcast, I think they're generally just interested in the world that we occupy, whether it's a fishing world or an instructor world. And I think, I think from our perspective and picking up the point that Mark said, is it's really easy for us to fall into jargon and to theory. And I think what we're trying to do in these podcasts is to ground it in kind of common sense and easy to understand concepts. And I think what I'd like to happen is A, to kind of inspire instructors to want to do more and know more. And I think also to help, I mean, we can help just fishers and casters with little nuggets of information as we go through, but also help them understand what to expect when they're going into a lesson and what good looks like. I think that helps in terms of the relationship between someone coming for a lesson and the instructor. They know what to expect. I think that's useful.
Because that's part of that process, isn't it? The nervousness, and I'm sure we touched on that before, that it's the unknown in some respects, isn't it? That people are, taking everything they're saying and doing intently and not relaxing, and that makes that process from the start a difficult one to unravel for unraveling the pupil, really, in some respects, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think the more open and relaxed people can come into lessons, the more they're going to get out of it. Definitely. Yeah.
I think very often when people come into lessons, they're quite tense. They don't really know what to expect. I think we said before it's a bit like they're anticipating a day at the dentist. but also, I found over the last couple of years or so that I resist now taking single lessons. So if somebody's coming for instruction, then they buy a block of lessons. And so it affords you the opportunity in the first session to break the ice a little bit and make them aware that it isn't going to be as painful as they anticipated. And that's made a massive difference to me in my instruction. Because it affords you the opportunity to just, chill everything out and you can spread your teaching over a period of time, which is much more effective than one single go.
That's a really interesting point, Mark. And I guess instructors are listening to that. How do you find that works then from a business point of view in the sense of instead of somebody turning up like traditionally can have an hour's lesson or whatever it may be, that you're advising them to buy or order or book a block of lessons? Do you find that works well with the end user as well?
Well, from a business, so if I was running it as a business, which like many instructors, I'm not, but nevertheless, I do charge. When I was thinking about this, I went into a state of, should I do it? Should I not do it? Will I lose the number of clients that I'm going to get in a year by asking people to pay a substantial amount of money for a block rather than a single lesson? And actually what's happened is the opposite has happened, I now have a busier diary with more clients coming for blocks of lessons than I did when I had singles. The only difference really being if we're looking at BFCC meets, for example, where you're only going to see somebody once at the BFCC until the next year, then you have to pack it into a single lesson. But generally speaking, people coming to that kind of event know that it's a pretty relaxed atmosphere anyway. They're not under, be under any pressure. And they've got distance casters to laugh at in the distance. So, it's been a very, very interesting thing. Lots and lots of advantages to it too.
Have you thought about that, Will? Do you employ that method?
No, I'm a bit of a mixed model. So I still have one-offs of people, often people who haven't tried it before and want to see what it's like and see what it's all about. And that they're not going to book a series of lessons. But I have quite a few people now who I see regularly and are on kind of a bit of a development path, personally, I enjoy that a lot. I like the variety of, you know, every person that you're meeting on different ground effectively. So I kind of quite like that. I think the good thing about having blocks of lessons and multiple lessons is you actually get to see whether or not what you're doing is working, you know, on lots of different levels. You know, are they inspired enough to have been away and practiced between sessions? Did the thing that we went through last time land? You know, because if it didn't, that's kind of on me. I need to kind of work out how to make it land this time. And so it's a very useful from an instructor's point of view, I think, to work out what's working versus a one-off who you're not going to see again. You don't know whether you did a great job or not, as we talked a bit about that last time. So I think it's really good if you can get people who are going to come back multiple times for both people's benefit, for the instructor and the student, going to get the most out of it.
If you think about how long it takes for somebody to go through basic training to become an instructor and the kind of changes we expect to see in the quality of their casting, this can take months, years.
Yeah.
And very often, I think, people coming for a single lesson are expecting some kind of magic dust from the instructor. And sometimes we're guilty of suggesting that we have magic dust.
Yeah.
And the three-lesson block gives me the opportunity to explain that I don't and that the real magic happens between the lessons, not in the lessons. And so, as I said earlier, I found it really quite relaxed, not just from their point of view, but from my point of view too. I can make a much longer assessment of what they need. I can adjust my instruction to fit the progress that they're making or not making. And I don't feel so guilty when it all goes to pot.
Yeah.
Excellent. Love it. It's just a really interesting, you know, you said so many interesting things. That block thing is a fascinating one. But also, you know, that you're getting that chance to work with those people and see those changes in between the lessons. And that's something I'm getting from both of you about it, is that that process from where they leave you to when they come back again. But it interests me deeply about that, and that you could easily go, and I know, you know, somebody books for an hour lesson, that you're trying to cram it, aren't you? You're trying to, and I think for the right reasons too, that you're trying to add value in as many ways that you possibly can, but you're probably losing the core part of it by doing that, aren't you? And throwing a little bit too much into the mix as well. So, yeah, so I hope people listening do think about that, because I think that's a really great idea, I have to say.
Well, you wouldn't learn to play the piano just in an hour, would you? You know, it's the same principle, is that this is a progressive developmental activity that you're going into. And so you have to buy into that right from the very beginning. I mean, you can get somebody casting and getting into a fish really, really quickly. We've all done it on the river, but the objectives are slightly different when we're talking about casting instruction as opposed to going out and getting somebody into a fish, where I'm not quite so bothered about whether or not the loop's 20 foot wide or whether it's, you know, it doesn't make that much odds. But when you're looking at a long-term developmental plan, it's a revelation doing it. There are people who book for three lessons and never come for the last two, but that's not my problem.
Will, have you got anything to add to that?
Yeah, I was just thinking that I think if it's going to be a one-off lesson, they're booking it and it's clearly a one-off lesson, I think you need to be clear about what's achievable and what's not. And I think it's a big skill, actually, in instructors beforehand, you know, talking to the people about what they think they can get out of it, what they're actually going to get out of it. And I think if you know it's going to be a one-off, you're going to focus very much on the basics so that they leave with something, you know, they do have something to take away with them to practice. I think the other thing that I try to do personally is to try and inspire them and motivate them to want to come back, or at least to want to go away and practice. So I think you need to give them, you can get some quick wins with them, which inspires them that, you know, this is a doable thing, it is achievable. And then to inspire them that there's more to go at and there's more to do, and it's how satisfying it is. I think that's a big thing in a one-off lesson.
Yeah. Practice is such a big deal. And I think, again, one of the advantages of block booking is that there's a kind of pressure on the client to go and practice. In North London, they're going to have to run the gauntlet of packs of feral cockapoos out on some park or heath somewhere. But it's quite surprising that people will overcome that kind of public embarrassment in order to avoid private embarrassment at the next session. It really is quite interesting.
Yeah, it's like having to do your homework, really, isn't it?
Exactly that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The interesting thing about this, actually, is that, you know, I know we're perhaps a little worried that we were going down instructor geekdom, but this is great information for people thinking about having some instruction themselves and what to look for, what to expect, and what to ask for as well, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Will.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think being clear about, you know, why you want a lesson, what is it you want to achieve, what, you know, and you can then have a good conversation about, you know, well, that's not really going to be doable in a single 2-hour lesson. You know, that is going to be a block of five lessons. If you want to do, you know, all the spay casts, both hands up, you know, and that kind of stuff, that's not a 2-hour lesson, I'm afraid. But let's talk about how we get there, you know, and what, and if you have only got 2 hours, what's going to be good for you? I think that's a really important thing. I think no matter, you know, everyone has their own needs and they should feel like they're getting value for money, and we shouldn't be imposing on them our model. You know, I think we just need to be clear about the limitations and try and find the best way that we can help them in the time available. Yeah.
Excellent. Anything to add to that, Mark?
Not really, no. I think in the past I might have been guilty of over-promising, but I've changed my tune on that score now.
Cool. One thing I wanted to circle on before we move on a little bit is, Mark, you mentioned BFCC. Now, I know what it is, but there may be a number of listeners whose ears may have pricked up, wondered, what's BFCC? And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about it and what it involves.
Well, the BFCC is the British Flycasting Club. And it was started quite a long time ago in order to afford an opportunity for competition casters to get together and do their thing, which is what still happens at the BFCC. There are a number of meetings that we have around the year. The calendar's just been prepared now. We normally have about five or six, depending on who or what is available for us to practice with. And supplementing the distance casting, we do instruction. So BFCC members can come along to a meeting and they can get instruction at that meeting for the cost of their membership, which is ridiculously cheap, I have to tell you. But it's always a cool day, and we have lots of people there who are prepared to help casters if they want to come along and have a go. Funny enough, we run short of instructors. So instructors who wanted to have or people who were budding instructors wanted to come along and have a go at actually teaching, they would be just as welcome as everybody else. It's a very informal affair, unless you're distance casting. But as I said to you, they are a little crazy. It's good to watch, though. It's quite extraordinary. If you see somebody casting a five-way 135, 40 feet, it's quite extraordinary and an enormously skillful exercise.
And they roll out around the country, I think, don't they?
They do, yeah. We go north, south, east and west, and some meets are very, very busy and some of them aren't quite so busy. But it's always a very interesting day for people who have never been before. There's no pressure. You don't have to do anything. You can sit and watch. You can have a cast. You can have a lesson. You can do whatever it is you want, and the day is yours.
Nice. And where can people find it? Do you know website details and stuff like that, in case they want to have a look?
Being technically inept, I've no idea, but you've probably got bfcc.com floating around somewhere. British Flycasting Club. Search it on Google. Woo! And away you go.
There we go. Added extra value already. So I wanted to move on to the process a little bit more. And I know you guys have come up with a basic model for instructors. I believe there's three parts to it: noticing, alignment, and intervention. I wondered if you could talk us through that a little bit, talking about, let's start at the very beginning with noticing and taking it on from there and see where that takes the conversation to start with. Will, please.
It's a model that we've developed within Scottish Game Angling Instructors Certificate, where we're trying to kind of give instructors a simple model that they can use as a framework for all lessons. So it's a kind of a circular model. So it starts off with noticing, then there's alignment, and then there's intervention, and then you use your noticing skills to work out, did that intervention work or not, and then you go around again. So it's as simple as that. Everything should start with noticing, and we talked a bit about this last time. This is an instructor's ability to see what's going on in front of them, to understand what's happening with a cast and why, and what you're going to do. You know, first is what the learner wants to do, what the objectives are, and it's one of those things, Pete, noticing, that's easy to say and harder to do, and I think from well, both an instructor and a caster's point of view, actually, fundamental, is when you're new to this game, we're not very good at noticing what's going on. So people and prospective instructors, they're not watching loops. They're not watching what's happening to the rod. They're not understanding what's happening with the learner. You know, what's happening with their body language. Are they happy? Are they confused? Are they whatever? And I think this stems from, I think the way we were all taught when we were at school is someone stands at the front of the class, tells you a load of stuff, you write it down, job done. It's a kind of a one-way thing, and it's just a standard lecture that gets given. And I think that's what people think instructing is going to be. Whereas the kind of thing that we do is much more interactive, and it has to be based on seeing what's going on. And so an instructor has to learn very close noticing skills. They're obviously sometimes looking for very fine details, and that takes practice. And you often, with people who are new to instructing, people who are aspiring to instructors, you often see they'll watch someone do one cast and leap in with, in inverted commas, a fix, because they've made their mind up and they probably missed all the important stuff. Whereas a kind of a more experienced instructor, you'll notice they'll watch a few casts and they might change angle. They might go and stand in the, get a different view of the thing, because they know that they have to see the whole thing and work out where to start. And I would say from, you know, we're talking about, you know, bringing in nuggets for casters and for learners. And for me, one of the big things is, like, do you know what's going on with your cast? Do you know what kind of loop you're throwing? Can you draw the loop shapes that you're throwing? Probably the, one of the biggest thing is, do you know what's happening with your back cast? You know, the number of times that someone's back cast can be just transformed by getting them to watch it and have their attention in the right place. So this noticing thing, we're trying to encourage it in learners, but we, from a, an instructor point of view, you need to be at another level of noticing. So that's the first bit, and the most, this is kind of the bedrock of instruction process. The next stage is alignment. And what this is about, it's a bit about communication skills and agreeing with the pupil what you've seen. You know, can they see the thing that you've seen? Yeah. Are you aligned on what they want to get out of it or what they were trying to do? Yeah. So there's a bit of a conversation going to go on. It's like, this is what I saw. Do you agree? Did you see it? Can we do it again so you can see it? So you're both in the same place about what it is, you, what's going on and what you're trying to do. Once you've done that, and that alignment phase can be as long or as short as it needs to be. You know, it might, at the, you know, the very beginning of a first lesson, you might be talking about, you know, your overall objectives and stuff, or it might be just a 30-second chat. Once you've done that and you're in the same place, so you're agreed on what's happening and where you're going, you can then actually go to the third stage, which is intervention, where you're going to try stuff and you're going to, you know, ask them to do something and try and change the way they are casting. And that's the process that we go through. So it's an easy thing to remember, noticing, alignment, intervention. And if you ever get stuck in the middle of a lesson, just go back to that, and it reminds you of the process that you want to go through. So that's what we put in place for just a basic thing for people to take away as prospective instructors. Yeah, so that's the basic process. Mark, I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that.
I'm not sure there is anything that I can add to that, Will, to be perfectly honest. I think for some people who are going to be listening to this, they want practical applications of the things that we're talking about as instructors. And if you're looking at noticing in particular, what we also want, as you rightly pointed out, our caster to be able to notice the things that we notice too. And we want to be able to make sure that what they see, they connect – with a movement or a motion of the rod. And very often, how we get somebody's attention focused onto the pieces of information that are out there available to them for them themselves to make those adjustments can be extraordinarily difficult. So when you're actually – we are looking as instructors at the line, for example, which is going to tell you a behavioral story of what went before – but the caster is probably staring at a bird somewhere flying over the Parisian suburbs. It's trying to get people to focus on the places where they're going to get that connection is really very difficult.
It is. And it absolutely blew my mind when I first started getting into this, Mark, where I thought – all I need to do is to tell someone to say, watch the rod tip or look at the loop or watch the line, and they'll do it. And it shows how hard it is for a beginner to pick up the right things, because they will nod and go, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And then they'll make a cast, and you can, if you're watching their eyes and where they're looking, they're not looking at the line or the loop or the rod. No. They're focused in the middle distance somewhere. I think it might be something to do with the kind of the cognitive load, and they're concentrating so hard that they're not looking where you want, but just getting them to look where they need to look.
The traditionally, we've concentrated on the wrong things. I'm not going to go into that, but we've focused on the wrong things. And so casters are trying to get this sensory information from the wrong places. Mm-hmm. Well, not the wrong places, but places that are at least advantageous to them. And so if you are trying to self-learn, for example, if we want to decouple this from instruction, the first thing to do is to get yourself into a position where you can see what's going on both ways. And that involves standing wide open and casting across your body so you can see what's going on. And we know that when we're instructing, particularly beginners, you want them to – the first thing you want to do is to teach somebody to look. And what to look at. But if we say, look at the loop or look at the fly leg or look at the front of the loop, or they've no idea what you're talking about. So you actually have to go through a process of gentle loop formation, little taps forming a wave in the fly line, and making them look at the wave. This thing is the thing that you're going to be looking at all the time from now on. Mm. This is a proto loop, and once you get it in the air, then that's what you're going to be looking at, this bendy bit, this shape in the line. And you can actually, you don't need an instructor to do that for you. You can do that yourself. Yeah. It's impossible to do it on a sound-only podcast, but it's not actually that difficult.
I think there's an interesting thing for me as well. One of the things I've found is to get people to have that level of focus that they are going to look where they're looking, you have to set that as the task.
So
it's not make a cast, it's just watch the loop.
Yeah.
And then you say, okay, I want you to make a couple of casts. And then what I've often done, I have like a kind of a white, clean little board. And I say, I need you to draw the loop that you've just seen. So it might be me casting a loop even. Can you draw this loop? Okay, you do one, draw it, what did it look like? That focuses their attention. You know, if they know they're going to have to draw it, they have to watch it. And I think anything that we can do that focuses attention, and I think it's interesting, if you're practicing on your own, if you're a caster just practicing on your own, make sure you've got some, you know, give yourself something to look at, whether it's the end of the fly line, whether it's a target. But be quite specific about the thing you're going to look at on that next cast. Tim Galway in his Inner Game of Tennis, when he talked about focus of attention, he said, you're not just watching the ball as it comes over the net. I want you to look at the lines on the ball as it comes over the net. And that, again, you're heightening the level of focus of attention that you need. I think if you're practicing on your own, get really picky. Say, I'm just going to look at you know, the end of the fly line, or I'm just going to look at the, you know, the leaf that I'm targeting. It's not going to be vague. I'm going to be really specific. And I think that helps train your focus of attention.
Can I just add to that, that on many occasions I have asked people what they're looking at. And occasionally you'll have somebody say, well, I'm looking at the fly, which I don't know about you guys, but I can't do that. It'd be like trying to spot a passing electron. So it's quite odd what people believe they're looking at as opposed to what they actually are looking at. And it's certainly pretty much number one of my objectives when I'm teaching anybody is to find out what it is that they're seeing.
Yeah. And I think as instructors, our ability, I think we might come to this later, but just the way to find out what they're looking at is to ask questions. And it's not just what we're looking at. It's like, what did you see? What did it look like? What happened? You know, you're just trying to heighten that focus of attention all the time, I think.
Yeah. You said a lot of really interesting stuff there, and also stuff, again, for the fly angler that is not an instructor, but about the visual. And I was going to ask you about that, and you answered it perfectly by saying putting everything over, canting the rod over and side casting or working from there. So it's all visual. And I was kind of thinking as well that I sort of came out of retirement and did a demonstration. It was a fishing demonstration at our gathering a couple of weeks ago. And I suddenly started talking about side casting and putting the line under the rod tip and all those sorts of bits and pieces as well. But also got into saying it's a great way to practice with the visual with that cast as well. But also I went off into another tangent and said, you know what, it's really interesting. I've just been thinking about it. If you are an experienced angler and want to try and think about your casting a little bit more, is teaching yourself with your non-dominant hand and learning something, that side of things, is that of interest? And I'm kind of thinking this from our listeners who are not going down the instructing route, but is that a way of sort of teaching yourself a little bit more about how your body's working and how the rod and line and everything else? I don't know. I was just throwing it out there.
Shall I have a go? I think it's different people respond to that in different ways, Pete, I've found. The most often I see this is if I'm doing double-handed lessons and you're switching them between left hand up and right hand up. Some people, let's say they're right-handed, and they'll go left hand up and they're superb straight away. You know, they can just do it, and a lot of the overpowering issues from their dominant hand go away, and it's just brilliant. And that's lovely when that happens. I would say an equal proportion go left hand up, and it just falls away. And I would put myself in that camp. I was so right hand dominant. It took me ages of practice and focus to get my left hand to work. I think it's actually, just from an instructor's point of view, it's a fascinating process to cast with your non-dominant hand, because you remind yourself what it's like when you're a complete beginner.
That's what I was kind of getting at, I think.
And you haven't got control. And I think it's really useful as an instructor to do that, because I think you're then in the position what it feels like to be a beginner and a learner. And you remind yourself. So I think that's a useful thing,
Mark?
Well, I'm currently wearing a thumb splint on my right hand. But I still cast right-handed because I can't scratch my ass with my left hand. There are people out there I know that have done all sorts of remarkable things with their left hand, but I'm not one of those people. And I promise you, I have no greater motivation than an arthritic thumb to learn with my other hand. But I think from an instructional point of view, I'm not convinced that it's of any major value for somebody who isn't in that instructor camp. because you're trying to make your dominant hand better. And I'm not sure that it benefits you in any way to refocus your attention onto your non-dominant hand in order to improve the other one. I mean, I would be open to discussion on that. But generally speaking, if I'm teaching, and I'm teaching recreational anglers most of the time, I'm not ever going to ask them to put the rod in the other hand. We're trying to improve their performance with the good hand rather than the other one.
Cool. I was kind of, there's a couple of parts to this. I was kind of thinking of somebody like an angler generally just practicing in their back garden to say, have a go at it and see what you take from there that you can translate, but clearly not the case. And the other thing for me is that, you know, I talk about it a bit, that I had a massive stroke 10, 11 years ago. I can now no longer go left hand up. I have to cack hand. Right. It is one of the few things that I struggle with, that I can't cast left hand up at all now. And it's really, really complex for me to do. So I cack handed, I'm absolutely fine. But that's, I don't know if it was my side of the brain that had an impact on, but that side of me, if I go there, I really, you'd think I'd never, not quite, but never picked up a fly rod before.
Well, I think that's a really good example, Pete, of it's, you know, there's no one cookie cutter way. Of learning this game, you know, and so there's no standard lectures that you can give that are going to work every time. You know, some might work half the time, but half not. You know, and I think that's one of the challenges we have as instructors is you're going to come across limitations and strengths and weaknesses, and it's how you can build around those to get the caster to where they want to be. And that's a really good skill to have, I think.
I had a very interesting conversation. Well, not really, a bit of a one-sided conversation with my 95-year-old mother the other day. She was a physiotherapist that worked with cerebral palsy children in her career. And she refers to an old Russian neuropsychologist called Alexander Luria. And he studied soldiers in the Soviet Union who had brain injuries and moved on to stroke victims, people who had car accidents and various other things. And he became very, very influential in how movement is managed by the brain from a neurological point of view. Now, I'm no expert in these things, but interestingly, from an instructional angle, He recognized that there are synergies between parts of the brain, between our melodic experiences and our movement experiences. And quite a lot of those things were used in recovery programs for stroke victims. and I think he wrote a book called The Mind of a Mnemonist. About how people remember and recall things, how they recall information, how they recall movement. And it was hugely influential. And I still use things like kinetic melody and connecting speech with the motion, with the movement, with onomatopoeia for stops and pops and also for visualization and programming. So you can use vocal visualization. You can talk through your false cast by saying loop, wait. Yeah. All of these things are things that I actually do when I practice. Yeah. So bearing in mind I'm out on the rugby pitches outside of the bowls club, talking to myself and making melodic noises. You do occasionally attract a little bit of attention, but it really works for me because I share all of the faults that I see or the difficulties that I see people having in lessons. I'm no different. I still whack it and chuck a tail or hit a bush it's the way I practice.
I think that's a really interesting one, Mark, because I one of the things I've used in the past, which I think might help just general casters, is you can sing or hum the power stroke. You know, we tie ourselves in knots on forums and in discussions about what we mean by correct power application. you can sing it, and it makes sense to people, you know. And it's not going to be like that. It's going to be woof, you know. And you get someone to actually do that and say it or sing it or hum it or whistle it while they're doing it, and they can do it.
You've and I put think some that, terrible ideas in my head now. Yeah. Oh, dear, oh, dear.
My
oh
work
dear.
Here is done, Mark. But it does work, I think, that you can those kind of things that are really nebulous and hard to get hold of, you can find another analogue for it, I think.
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
That's Alexander Luria.
Brilliant.
Fantastic. Fantastic. So what is the next thing people should be thinking about, concentrating on as an instructor? If they have, we've talked about the three core things as well, but is there, you know, the practice regimes, is there things that they should be looking there? Or is there other external things that they should be looking at when they're teaching somebody some casting?
I think you've hit the head on the word with external, Pete. And it's a big thing. And again, well, for me, it's massive. It's allied to attention and noticing. And what we want is for the attention of the caster to be outside of their body. We don't want them to be thinking about their joints and their limbs or anything like that. We want their attention to be on the rod, the line, the loop, the target, whatever. Even the rod handle, anything that's like outside of the skin. And we call them, technical term incoming, external cues. And I think that's a big shift from traditional instruction, not just in fly casting, but in sports instruction generally, where, you know, there used to be a lot of focus, I know when I started out, on wrist control, is you need to have a firm wrist. You know, what does a firm wrist mean? Or a stiff wrist? Or, you know, and if you ask someone to think about their wrist, that's all they can think about in that moment. They won't be thinking about the rod, the line, the loop, whatever. They find it really difficult. Whereas what we know as experienced casters is that for a nice, efficient cast, we should be using kind of all our joints. You know, for distance casts, we should be using all our body. And you can only do that if you're relaxed. And the way to do that is to get your attention away from the limbs and the body. And this thing about external cues, it's been researched in sports science over and over and over again. People comparing external cues, so in our world, watch the rod, watch the line, watch the loop, versus do this with your hand, do this with your arm. And there's been lots of research, both kind of cues, and uniformly across different sports and tests and research, external cues are better for people learning things. What tends to happen with an external cue is the body sorts it out. Our bodies are just brilliant at this stuff. You know, it's like running up and down stairs. We're not thinking about the angle of our femur to the rest of our leg or what our foot's doing. We just see the stairs and we go up them. Our attention is on the next step. And that's what we're aiming for in instruction. I think it's a big shift, this movement from internal to external cues. And I think, again, the more we can get, if you're just a caster out there listening, you know, it goes back to this attention. Get it on the rod tip, get it on the line, you know. It's funny, in lessons like 15 years ago when I started, I would have used the term firm wrist, or we would have talked about the wrist a lot. I can't remember the last time I asked someone to do anything with their wrist or arm or whatever. Now it's much more, you just ask them to focus externally and the body fixes it itself. So big change, I think. And it's really kind of revolutionized the way I teach. Mark, I don't know if you want to add.
Well, there's a couple of things I would add to that, and that is there is a thing called white bear theory. And what white bear theory is, that if you get somebody to think specifically about a particular thing, in Will's case, a wrist, And then you want them to change and forget about the wrist and concentrate on something else. They won't be able to remove the white bear from their minds. And so you plant this irritant into your lesson, which you don't really need to do. I mean, Will's absolutely right. The whole business of external cueing means that, by and large, you don't have to talk about wrists and elbows and knees and bumps a daisy. It's not at all necessary. So for a beginner in particular, we need to get them to the point where they can see things that are going to generate the most value to them, and their wrist isn't it. You might be able to talk to a very experienced caster who's capable of micro changes to their behavior, but for a beginner or a recreational angler who hasn't got that kind of fine skill management, it's a waste of time talking about limbs, joints, and everything that goes with it.
And it's quite a hard thing, I think, as an instructor. You know, going back to the noticing skills, you can see that they're doing something that's not optimal with their body. So you can see that they're breaking their wrists, or they're not using their body correctly. And the overwhelming temptation is to dive in, tell them to do something different with their body. But you have to resist it, I would say. Your brain is telling you desperately, just tell them to kind of like raise their hand higher or do whatever, but you need to resist it. And I think that, I know a lot of the discussions I've had with other instructors, there's quite a bit of resistance to this, because you can get some results from internal cues. You can do it. And the way I put it is, I'm not saying you can't talk about the body. I'm not saying you can't have this conversation about how the body works and what it is you're trying to do, or the danger of like trying to cast in a certain way that's going to hurt you. But that conversation has to happen before the actual action. You know, so you can talk about the principles and what it is we're trying to get you to do, but the cue before the action has to be outside of the body. And when they're actually in the action, they're not thinking about it. They're thinking about external. So before they get going, you can talk all you want about the body and stances, you know, how you're going to stand, which way you're going to face, getting yourself ready, getting aligned. You can do that if you want. And I do, especially with spay casting. Start positions, I think, are quite important. But when you're in that movement, when you're actually making the cast, your attention needs to be outside of the body. And external stuff. So for me, it's not an either or. You know, don't get your knickers in a twist. If you want to talk about start positions and the way the body works, do it, but not actually in the moment.
Jeez. Like, yeah. You probably saw me suddenly shoot back, and I thought, gee, what you're saying is actually really revolutionary, and it's
not in the rest of the world.
In fly casting. That's exactly what I mean. And it's really asking people to take a leap of faith is the wrong word. But what you're saying has really, really resonated with me as somebody who's taught a lot in the past. But geez, this is really important stuff that you're covering here. And you're not turning it upside down. What you're actually doing is saying this is the way it can work, and it can work efficiently and effectively for the person who's having that tuition. It really has hit me quite hard with what you've been saying and where you're getting with this. And of course, I've been listening to everything you've been saying on the previous one and this one, but then that external thing is quite extraordinary, what you're saying there. And that is, and that's going to be a really difficult, and that's why I think I'm using leap of faith, because it's a difficult one, isn't it, to explain to people who have been teaching in our little sphere a certain way for so long, saying, park that there, now try this. And that must be, I guess, where you've been talking about this for a number, and with others, a number of years now, I would guess. that it really is quite a pivotal point, as I see it, in tuition and fly casting, the teaching of it, isn't it? And I can only applaud, actually, because what you're doing, it's absolutely extraordinary. And I'm absolutely thrilled to hear that where you've picked this up and moved it in a direction that's more aligned with many other pastimes now. And perhaps we need that sometimes to push things on. And, you know, we get this, I'm sort of kind of okay with the fact that fishing is this little sphere. There's never going to be billions of people doing it, certainly in the UK, or millions and millions of people. And I'm okay with that. And, you know, we always get this clarion call, we've got to bring more people, we've got to bring more people in. But this way is a better way to bring people in and to teach them how to fly cast.
It's
really, yeah, really that's the really extraordinary thing about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think your phrase, Pete, act of faith, is bang on. And I think when you're trying this as an instructor, you're trying it for the first time, it's a bit of a deep breath moment. You know, I can remember doing it. You know, I'm not going to tell them what to do with their body. I'm just going to get them to watch something, you know, and use that as the cue. And it's a bit like kind of, you know, I don't know, tightrope walking without a safety net the first time you do it. But when it works, it's a real hairs on the back of your neck stand up, because it's amazing. You know, you can just, someone who's been struggling to get something and you just find the right cue for them, the right thing for them to put their attention on and get them to put their attention on it. And it is like magic, isn't it, Mark? It just suddenly clicks.
It feels like magic, even though you know that it isn't. It's
exactly.
Designed to do what it does. It's actually made my lessons simpler. And simple for me means that it's simple for the caster too. And that's it's great doing it. I really like doing it. I used to get sort of collywobbles before I started a lesson, thinking, well, I could really blow this one up. But now I'm much more confident in the process is it's going to work.
Yeah, me too.
I think that's absolutely extraordinary. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, if I was still doing what I was doing, that I'd be thinking, geez, how am I going to do this tomorrow? And that's the hard part, isn't it, to break free of the shackles and say, look, it's okay, this is going to work. And is there a resource that, because I think if there are instructors listening to this, they should be on the phone to you guys right away saying, how do we make this work? Is there somewhere that people can see this, read more about it, and they're getting a good sense of it from you, but is there more? Yeah. And why don't you guys write a book or do something about this? Because it's game-changing. It really is.
Well, it's funny you should say that, Pete. funny you should say that. So as part of the SGAIAC course, Scottish Game Language Instructors, we have a learning centre. It's an online learning centre. And to date, it's been very technical focused, because we have to get people up to speed with the technicalities of how a cast works. And we're just finishing off. We've built another half of the learning centre, which is just about teaching, which is just about this stuff. And we're just about to launch it. I think by the time of the next podcast, we'll be ready to go. But the plan is we're going to make that accessible for a charge, but we'll make it accessible to both SGAIAC instructors and to other instructors. And I would say if people are interested in this stuff, you can contact me, and I'm happy to take names and make sure people get access if they want to that stuff. But that's exactly what we've been trying to do, really, is to pulled together, and Mark's helped us with this as well, to try and pull together a resource where all of this stuff is in one place without getting too techy and too kind of science-based. But that's what we're trying to do, really. So if anyone's interested, just get in touch with us.
one of the things that we were thinking of doing with the BFCC, Pete, was filming some of the teaching activities that we do. And then we can offer two things. One, we can say to somebody who wants to self-learn, these are the kinds of drills that you can do for yourself, providing you look at this or you pay attention to that and so on and so forth. And we can also use them as a mechanism for explaining the theory behind the delivery for instructors. To do that, we need to have somebody who's slightly more photogenic than I am, though. That's the only problem. So we're trying to recruit.
I think you're made for the screen, Mark.
Come along and do a bit of filming.
Absolutely fantastic. Look, guys, we've spoken for well over an hour now. Is there anything, we've got a third one coming, but yeah. Is there anything you want to add at this stage that ties in with what you're saying? Because I'm not even bloody instructing now, and I've had a eureka about it all. So mm-hmm. I'm hoping that's had a similar effect on instructors, but also people who are flycasters who may look at things from a different angle now. And I'm really excited about what you've been saying in the previous podcast, but even more so in this one as well. But is there anything you want to add to tie it up? Are you happy to sort of stop here to bring us in for the next one next time?
I think it's a mistake to ask us whether we want to add anything, Pete, because we'd be here for another 12 months. So maybe we should park it for the next revelatory experience for everybody.
Yeah, definitely. I think if you're a caster, then just I think the thing to take about is think about what you're looking at when you're casting. And if you're starting out, and look at your back cast, please. Just see what's going on with that. That would be my number one.
Brilliant. Anything else to add there, Mark?
No, nothing.
Well, I can only applaud. That has been absolutely fantastic. And this old dog has suddenly thought, wow, this is extraordinary. And I'm thrilled that we have people like yourself who are prepared to look at our pastime and look at it through a slightly different lens, a more modern lens, in fact, and say, look, we can make this easier and more enjoyable for people. So on behalf of listeners, instructors out there, I'd like to thank you for part two of this trilogy, and I'm very, very much looking forward to part three. Thank you, Will, and thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good to see you as always.
Well, everyone, this has been another episode of the podcast. I hope you've enjoyed this one as much as me. I was quite sort of giddy, I have to say that. It was just fascinating listening to the guys chat there. I should mention as well, we have the Tweed Salmon Festival coming up. I'm going to be there. I'm going to be podcasting. I'm going to be on the Yeti bar, I think it is. So I'm going to be in there podcasting. So if you are coming along, come and say hello. I'd love to speak with you, and perhaps I might even poke a microphone in your face. But thank you so much for listening to the podcast. There'll never be any charge from these. It's just amazing to be able to share groundbreaking stuff like what Mark and Will are talking about with you. And I hope it helps you enjoy your fly fishing even more. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Fly Culture podcast, brought to you in association with the voice of game angling, Trout and Salmon, where Pete is the editor.